Imagine this. The government is in charge of money that belongs to a specific group. Now, there's no signed contract saying they absolutely have to protect it, but they're managing it anyway. Can that group later demand accountability if those funds are, well, mishandled? This is pretty much the core legal puzzle the Navajo tribe brought before the courts way back in 1980. Welcome to this deep dive. Today, we're exploring a really landmark case, Navajo Tribe of Indians v. United States. What makes this case so foundational, especially if you're maybe grinding through law school right now, is how it explores something called implied fiduciary duty, specifically within federal Indian law.
Exactly. And what's really fascinating here is that the court basically determined a major legal obligation existed, this fiduciary duty, meaning the government was legally bound to act in the tribe's best interest, even though, like you said, it wasn't explicitly spelled out in any treaty or statute. It was implied.
Right, implied. So we're going to dig into those central legal questions, the court's reasoning behind it all, and really why this decision still shapes the relationship between the U.S. government and Native American tribes today.
Mm.
We'll also touch on the specific claims involved. It wasn't just one thing, right? It covered mismanagement of timber, land, financial resources, even challenging accounting reports going all the way back to the Treaty of 1868. So this wasn't exactly a sudden dispute.
Oh, absolutely not. There's long history here. The bedrock really is the Treaty of 1868. That's the pivotal document kind of defining the whole relationship between the Navajo tribe and the U.S. government.
Okay.
Then, if you fast forward quite a bit to 1951, the Navajo tribe actually started filing their legal claims. This was under the Indian Claims Commission Act. Congress set that up specifically to handle claims against the U.S. by tribes.
Right, I remember that act.
Yeah, so they were seeking compensation for land cessions, sure, but also, crucially, raising concerns about how their resources were being managed.
Mm-hmm. So decades in the making, really.
Yeah.
And when the Indian Claims Commission was dissolved, the case didn't just disappear, did it?
No, no. In 1976, the case moved over to the Court of Claims. And that transition itself, it really underscores just how long and persistent the tribe's efforts were to get these issues addressed. It was definitely not a quick fix.
Makes sense. Okay, so by 1980, when it gets to this court, the key legal question is really sharp. It's essentially, did the U.S. government owe a fiduciary duty, that special duty of care to the Navajo tribe regarding how they manage tribal assets, even if no specific treaty or law explicitly said so? That's the heart of it, isn't it?
Precisely. And the court's answer, a clear yes. They found that this trust relationship was, in fact, implied. And the court's rationale is really interesting here. It pretty much hinged on one key element.
Control.
Control.
Mm.
Not necessarily a written promise, but the actual control exercised. What exactly did the court say about that? How did they articulate it? Well, the majority opinion put it quite directly. They stated, and I'm quoting loosely here, where the federal government takes on or has control or supervision over tribal monies or properties, the fiduciary relationship normally exists, even though nothing is said expressly about a trust fund or a trust or fiduciary connection. There's a caveat about Congress potentially saying otherwise, but the core idea is control.
Huh. So it's that inherent power dynamic. If you're controlling someone else's stuff, their money, their property, an obligation to act in their best interest just sort of naturally follows, unless, you know, Congress specifically carves out an exception. That feels like a pretty fundamental principle of responsibility.
It does.
But as the court also pointed out, even with this implied duty established, the tribe still needed to connect it to concrete legal obligations, right? It wasn't a blank check.
Exactly right. The court was clear. While the fiduciary duty could be inferred from that government control, the tribe still had to point to substantive sources of law. That means things like the Treaty of 1868 itself, or specific statutes or executive orders, to define the particular duties the government owed and might have breached.
Okay, so the implied duty sets the general stage, the overall responsibility, but the specifics of what the government should have done or not done still have to be found in those other legal documents. So, for instance, even if the 1868 treaty didn't explicitly use the words fiduciary duty, the tribe's claims about, say, timber mismanagement would still be linked back to whatever the treaty did say about timber resources.
That's a perfect way to summarize it, yeah. Now, this also leads into another key part. The burden of proof. Initially, the government's position was basically, hey, tribe, you need to prove we messed up. But the court didn't quite see it that way, did they?
No, they definitely didn't. And this was a really pivotal shift in the ruling. The court essentially said, wait a second, You, the U.S. government, are acting like the trustee here in this implied relationship. Therefore, you have the responsibility to account for how you manage those tribal assets.
And that lines up perfectly with basic trust law principles, doesn't it? If you're a trustee, you owe the beneficiary in accounting. It's fundamental. The court basically reasoned that this principle applies here, too. So the government had to show what happened to the tribal assets, including justifying any offsets or restorations they claimed.
So it wasn't on the tribe to somehow dig up all the proof of mismanagement from the outside looking in. The burden shifted. The government had to open its books, essentially, and prove they'd done their job right and provide a clear accounting. That's a huge rebalancing in the legal fight.
It really is significant. And speaking of accounting, when the government did present its reports, the court found them lacking. They called them partial accounting. The court was expecting, based on those trust principles, a complete and detailed accounting.
So just throwing some numbers out there wasn't good enough. They needed a thorough, transparent record of exactly how they managed the tribe's resources over time.
Correct. And this touches on another concept the court mentioned, differential fiduciary standards. Basically, the court acknowledged that, yes, private trust law provides a good starting point, a useful framework, but the relationship between the U.S. government and Native American tribes is unique. It's shaped by history, treaties, federal oversight.
Right. It's not the same as a private individual managing a small family trust.
Exactly. So in not every single rule that applies to a private trustee automatically translates perfectly to the government-tribe situation. There are differences to consider.
That makes complete sense. The scale, the history, the sovereign-to-sovereign aspect, it's fundamentally different. Okay, so let's pull this together. What was the final, ultimate holding of the court in Navajo v. United States?
Well, the court clearly held, one, that the U.S. government did have an implied fiduciary duty to the Navajo tribe regarding managing their assets. Two, that the burden of proof for providing a proper accounting rested squarely on the government. And three, that the accounting provided so far was simply insufficient to meet that duty.
And this case wasn't just a one-off decision that gathered dust, was it? It had ripples, significant legal legacy.
Oh, absolutely. Huge legacy. This case laid crucial groundwork, really vital precedent, for the 1983 Supreme Court case, United States v. Mitchell People, often call it Mitchell II. That case built directly on the foundation from Navajo v. United States. And importantly, Mitchell II established that tribes could actually seek monetary damages for breaches of this implied fiduciary duty.
Ah, so Navajo established the duty and the burden of proof for accounting, and Mitchell II confirmed that failing that duty could lead to financial liability for the government.
Precisely. It added teeth to the enforcement. And the influence doesn't stop there. Navajo v. United States is still relevant in modern cases. You see references to it in cases like the 2003 Navajo Nation v. United States, which also dealt with fiduciary claims, this time specifically involving the Indian Tucker Act. That's the law allowing tribes to sue the government for money damages under certain conditions.
Okay, so for all you law students listening, this case is definitely not just some historical artifact. It's living law still shaping arguments and outcomes today. So, boiling it down, what are the absolute key principles you should take away from Navajo v. United States?
Okay, a few critical takeaways. First, courts look very closely at the level of government control or supervision over tribal assets. That's often the trigger for finding an implied duty. Second, the specific nature of the relationship, the history, the treaties between the government and the particular tribe matters. It's not one size fits all. And third, remember this nuance. Even though the duty can be implied from control, tribes still need to anchor their claims in those substantive sources of law. They need to point to specific treaty provisions, statutes, or regulations that define the actual obligations the government supposedly violated.
So the implied duty creates the general responsibility, but you still need specific legal hooks to hang your hat on for a particular breach and remedy.
Exactly. And don't forget that critical shift in the burden of proof regarding accounting. The analogy you used earlier is perfect, like a financial advisor needing to account for your investments. The court said the government, as trustee, bears that burden. They have to show their work, essentially.
That's a really useful way to think about it. So yeah, Navajo v. United States, it's truly a cornerstone case. It really illuminates that complex trust relationship and the government's ongoing duty to be accountable for how it manages tribal resources.
Absolutely. It really highlights that fundamental idea. Exercising control brings responsibility, even if it's not all spelled out in a contract.
You know, thinking about that central idea duty implied from control, it makes you wonder, how might that principle apply in other areas? other situations where the government has significant influence or control over specific groups or maybe resources, even without an explicit promise to protect them?
That's a great question.
And thinking specifically about our audience, you know, as future lawyers, what role do you see yourselves possibly playing in ensuring the U.S. government actually upholds these fiduciary responsibilities to tribes? It's definitely a vital area of law that needs ongoing attention and advocacy. We really encourage everyone listening to explore those related cases we mentioned, like Mitchell II and the later Navajo Nation cases. Getting a deeper understanding of this evolution is crucial. Understanding these historical legal battles is just so essential for navigating contemporary practice, especially anywhere near Indigenous rights or government accountability. Thanks so much for joining us on this deep dive.